Okay, today is February 24th. I should know that. My mom's birthday was yesterday.
So it's mine.
Oh.
It was yesterday.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
We're here with Phil, and I'm going to butcher your last name again. Pelletieri?
Pelletieri.
Pelletieri. Okay. This is the second interview, the follow-up interview. We're again here at Steenbach Library inside the UW-Madison Archives, and my name is Troy Reeves. Phil, even though you said your name there, I hope you would say your name and spell your name so we can get the sound quality
sure.
Where we
Phil
want to
Pelletieri,
be.
Phil Pelletieri, it's P-E-L-L-I-T-T-E-R-I.
Okay, I'm going to slide this a little closer to you. All right, so we have a list of things we want to talk about today, or I want to ask today. So my first question is a fairly specific one, and it is, do you recall your feelings, if you can recall them, when you discovered that the lab you were working at actually was going to become a full-time job for you?
Well, honestly, it took a number of years to finally get enough confidence that that was going to be a full-time job. Originally, it was a three-month appointment. The dean, Don Peterson at the time, the extension dean, was very supportive, and after the first 3 months and the feedback they got from the county extension offices, they said, well, we can try to find funding to get you through until, you know, through the next summer. But the lab was on soft money for a very long time, and slowly but surely things got built up. To be honest, I had applied and was looking to go elsewhere where there was more opportunity, at least you could see a permanent type job. So I had applied for a position with the Department of Agriculture in the state, and it was looking at other places also. And so it took some time, and it wasn't as for lack of support. The department was always very supportive. Even, you know, the deans were supportive. It's just a question of budgets and how things finally evolved. As I said, it was kind of a slow add-on to hard funds, but there was always a soft fund supplement until probably about 7 or 8 years into the position.
Okay. So I think if I read your CV right, when it became full-time, I think it was 75% extension, 25%
teaching.
And
really the justification there was I got involved with teaching in short course program. And really, the teaching dollars were the first hard dollars they could come up with. And so that was part of the cut is I would teach short course and help out in other courses as needed. And so as I said, it was as much, Mallory Bush was the chairman at the time, and it was as much a way of getting some solid dollars funding.
And I want to ask about short course here shortly, but I want to make sure we get any anecdotes you might have about the early years of the lab, or even that first summer of the lab.
Well, it was kind of interesting. So, you know, the people I worked with the most were the other extension entomologists in the department. And really what the idea of the diagnostic lab was, aside from dealing with the day-to-day calls that came in and specimens, if I got into a situation that was subject-specific, let's say an outbreak in potatoes from a commercial grower, well, we had a commercial vegetable entomologist, and so I both knew where to get a hold of them, and I could kind of screen, you know, things that they really needed to know. And again, what they were excited about at the time is that they were in the field all the time, you know. So this was basically, we had somebody that could kind of, you know, hold the ship down in the department during the summer, but yet could still get a hold of them if there was something that really needed to be done. And so it kind of lessened their workload a little bit, but that was just fine. And, you know, from my perspective, I always had backup. But what happened that first year is Ellsworth Fisher, who was our extension field crop person, retired. And we got caught that spring with an outbreak of the alfalfa weevil, which is an insect originally from North Africa, and it was the first time we had an insect that could cause significant damage to first crop alfalfa. And so farmers never had to pay attention to insects, and so they just got hammered. The insect chews all the leaves off, and, you know, no crop. And by the time you discover it, it's kind of over, and again without having any experience. So that really was pretty traumatic, of trying to, you know, hold things together without really having the expertise. The good news out of this is we have very quickly, the replacement was Dr. John Wedberg, and he was an extension entomologist in Illinois who had experience with alfalfa weevil. So John came aboard, I think, in July of that year, so at least we got reinforcements pretty quick, but it was pretty traumatic. So as I said, it was a major crop pest that we hadn't had to deal with, and a lot of people that first year really got hurt by it. But once you kind of got people's eyes open and talked about what kind of options, you know, and what seems to be the pattern of so many of these invasive insects, it was the most severe when it first got here anyway, and it kind of has mellowed out from, we've got beneficial insects and other things that have moved in and kind of kept the cap on it a little bit more. But as I said, that was an interesting situation. I do remember that the dean at the time of the college was called numerous times at home during the weekend by farmers who had concerns and questions. And once the dean has concerns, you can imagine the department tried to pull it together as quick as we could as far as dealing with these things.
So how would you and or your fellow entomologists deal with this in the 70s? I mean, would you bring farmers together in a meeting?
Well, you'd get it out. So again, you know, our main conduit was through the county extension offices. And so the two things we had to come up with here is what kind of chemical recommendations, you know, what chemicals are registered, how to use them, those kind of things. And then also how to manage. And, you know, this was just about the time that we were starting to get into integrated pest management. So we're using scouting and counting insect numbers to figure out, are we at an economic problem or not? And so, we got it out as many ways. But at that time, even the Office of Emergency Government got involved. I mean, it really was a big deal. The main problem with that we saw, and again, without Ellsworth being on board, is they had come up with pesticide recommendations that weren't even legal, which was a little frustrating, or words were misspelled. I mean, it was, but again, they just didn't have any entomologists, and they were trying to do the best they could, but right. It was kind of out of their area of expertise.
Okay. So unless there are other, you know, anecdotes that now come to mind about these first couple years in the lab, I want to move to talking about your teaching, specifically the short course.
Sure. So that, honestly, Dr. Mark Scriber, who was in the department at that time, had been teaching short course, and Mark, something had come up, and he had asked if I could cover a couple lectures the first time, so I did, but the next year it came up, and Mark, you know, had a very busy schedule and whatnot, and basically, I think if I remember right, I taught better than half the class. And then the department decided, boy, that would be a great opportunity. And so, you know, every day for 6 weeks in the third term. And it had helped because I had, you know, Mark's notes to kind of go back on and see which way he went with it. I had not had exposure to the short course program before that. And it's an interesting, rewarding, but it's a very different kind of teaching and student than we deal with traditionally on campus. Most of these students probably would not get in with their academic records. You couldn't teach theory. I mean, these are people who are planning to go back to the farm and say they want practical information. And so that's basically, you know, how to identify these insects, how to monitor for them, how to make some decisions. And so I even, you know, the course evolved to basically being open book. So it wasn't so much, you didn't want these students to memorize things. You wanted to have them know where to go for information when they needed to and the like. And so, we found it very rewarding. But as I said, you took a whole different strategy with those students than you normally would for a course. And you didn't talk about insects in Florida or anywhere else. They just want to know what was going on at home. And as I said, you kind of worked it up from there.
So, I think you said this, but I want to ask it directly. So you learned on the job teaching this course that you had to that it was different than teaching to, you know, undergraduates or graduate
yes.
students.
Oh yeah, definitely. As I said, both because you know, even with open book exams, the first exam. I mean, one of the things with the students you find is they just didn't have good study skills, And some of them, honestly, had difficulty reading well enough. I mean, there were students I had over the years that I had to give oral exams because they couldn't read the exam clear enough or understand well enough to be able to write the exam. And but again, when you looked at what their purpose was for being here, it wasn't. Yeah, I had no problem with that. That, as I said, it really, really got me to focus on what would be used for them in the future. So,
yeah. You said open book, but was there also hands on?
Yeah. So, Mark had not quite done this, but I ended up developing a lab. And in some of this, honestly, because of other extension workshops and whatnot we did, I kind of had an idea what might work. And so, one of my early disappointments is, you know, after teaching them for 6 weeks, and like, you'd show them a grasshopper and ask them to identify it, and they weren't even in the ballpark. I mean, some things that you would think that would be relatively easy. So basically, the whole direction of the lab was to get them hands-on with things. And then at the end of the course, I would give them a 20 insect unknown that they could use, again, picture sheets and other references to help them identify, but it was kind of a quick lab practical. And many students did very well, but still it was always kind of interesting. And I've seen this in other areas that I worked of people just having some difficulty on some of the details in the like. But
So was this your primary teaching responsibility during these early years?
Yes. Over the years, one of my colleagues, Walt Gomarek, was teaching a department course called 301, and Walt developed some medical problems before that. And so, you know, I stepped up with Dan Young in our department to teach that. Originally, we were going to put that on... both aside from teaching it on campus, and we were teaching it on Saturday mornings, among other things. We were looking for non-traditional students, among other things, and Walt was hoping to do some kind of you know, this was kind of before Skype and some of those other things, but ways of broadcasting this to other places. But when Walt got sick, we had to kind of can that part of the idea. In that course in particular, it's kind of an entomology for non-majors, or, you know, the traditional physics for poets type of direction. So it was interesting because we had a lot of education students and the like. And I never found insects to be hard to sell to people. I mean, there's just lots of interesting things. And so, as I said, I found that very rewarding to be involved with that, even though the time frame was a little bit. And one of the tough things about extension is in the winter months, you're doing a lot of night and weekend travel and meetings already. And so just to add more weekend stuff is not, you know, your favorite time to teach, but that's the way it worked out. And as I said, the interesting thing was kind of opening our eyes to other audiences or other time frames that might work better for people than kind of the traditional campus classes.
And so was that an ongoing?
No, so it was just that 1 year we covered, and in that course has since evolved in the department into really a very, very successful and large enrollment class. And then, you know, interesting enough, in the extension group, I mean, I was kind of considered a generalist, you know, because I had to kind of cover a little bit of everything. And one of the things that happened relatively early is we lost an extension position when Dr. Gomarek retired. And he was basically the medical entomologist, the urban structural entomologist, and did a lot of beekeeping work. And so when those things happen, you kind of have to divide responsibilities as best you can. And so I kind of assumed that in the department, although I do not really have much in the way of beekeeping expertise. So we kind of weren't able to hold that tradition. But that also had come in conjunction. We had a USDA bee lab here originally when I started. And the bee lab left in the 80s. And so we kind of lost a whole lot of expertise in honeybee in particular. But again, from my perspective, it was an opportunity, you know. I mean, much like short course, originally that's what I walked into. This is an opportunity to kind of, you know, get your hands into more things, make yourself a little bit more valuable in the department mission, and you know.
Could you spell that person's last name?
Gomarek?
Yeah.
G-O-J-M-E-R-A-C.
Thank you. Didn't mean to put you on the spot there.
Yeah, no problem.
So... let's move now from teaching to your media responsibilities, or what became sort of your media responsibilities.
Yeah. And that evolved. I don't know if we originally thought that that would be an opportunity or a responsibility of the position. But again, if there was a problem and somebody called, I was always there. So it got to the point, and then once you start to make those contacts with the media, so you know it usually turned out that whether it was newspaper requests, short radio interviews, or TV pieces, we'd probably do anywhere from 60 to 100 plus a year. You know, just depending if the insects were misbehaving, then there was more people that wanted it. Although, one of the interesting perspectives is, you know, the university has been involved, and we did this quite a bit early in my career. We would do various press releases, and sometimes they would catch, most of the time not. But you'd do a story with somebody, and if it hit AP, it just got into a frenzy. And it was really, in some cases, kind of silly, because the better science was in the press releases, typically. I mean, you had a good story to tell here. So often it would be something like mosquitoes and what's the mosquito prediction and the like. And the problem with AP is they often rewrite and paraphrase what you said, so they often don't get it right. And then again, everybody wanted their soundbite of the same thing. And so, you know, you learn how to deal with it. You learn how to talk in a way that they hopefully would understand. You know, one of my experiences is that, you know, the only really fun times talking to the media is when you deal with a science writer, because they had enough biology that they understood. Whereas in other cases, you had to be really quite careful on how you talked and what you said. And I'd learned that pretty quick of how to set the story out and try to explain it in a way that hopefully they would get it right. And most of the time they would, or at least close enough that the information got through. But And I really equate that a lot. Again, a lot of the media people did not have enough biology background to understand really what was important, and especially in the way we word things. So,
do you have what little work I've done with the media, I have a couple examples in my head of where I said something and then I read it and it...
A few of those, although there was two times in my career, I guess I remember, of maybe the best way of putting it is getting burned. One was kind of an innocent, and this was relatively early. A TV person had come up, and honestly, I was doing a field day up at Arlington, and there at that time was an oil crisis. And the person, you know, was looking for interviews and asked if they could talk. And the question that was given to me was, did I think that the cost of chemicals in particular would be going up because of the oil crisis? Well, I mean... I'm an entomologist, and we do deal with chemicals. That seemed a little off, and, you know, so I kind of said, well, you know, you might expect, since many of these are oil-based, but I really didn't come out strongly. But that evening, the lead story on the news was Phil Pelletieri said, you know, the cost of pesticides are going to increase dramatically because, and this is basically, again, what the reporter came in. That was their agenda to begin with, and they just were looking for stuff. So they said that's when I kind of learned to be a little more careful with my wording. The other one, honestly, was a few years later, but a very interesting case of an exotic ant that came in. And, I mean, there's a whole story about that. But the bottom line, I got a call from the Wall Street Journal a number of months after this happened. And this exotic ant that showed up in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, among other things, it would sting. Not a painful sting, but it's something that would get your attention. And what the reporter said is, I heard that you guys have... The story was supposed to be on global warming. And he said, I heard you guys have fire ants in Wisconsin. And I said, no, it's not fire ants, and tried to give him a little explanation again, this was this exotic ant that showed up the first time here. And, you know, in fact, we even had to go to Harvard to get an insect identification because it's something we hadn't seen. And thought we had pretty much dismissed this. And the next day it came out. And the problem was, in particular, because it was a hospital, this is kind of a sensitive situation, and I really did not divulge what the hospital was, but there's only two hospitals in Sheboygan. And so when it hit, the hospital's PR people were very disappointed. And the pest control company I worked with originally that had found the case, and myself, we were all disappointed. And we had to literally get a hold of the CDC to get an opinion, because this was not of public health significance in the hospital. It's something they eventually dealt with. But again, they were worried about the PR, and it blew over pretty quick. But the same thing, you sit back and kind of learn how to be quite careful because there are sometimes, again, these unintended consequences of how you divulge information. And so they said you always are a little leery. But that was the two cases I remember getting burned. But most of the time, as I said, people are just looking for information, and you know, and you kind of try to steer them as best you could. And in particular, if I had colleagues in the department that had stronger expertise, as I said, I try to work a little bit as a clearinghouse there, but and draw other people in the department into talking with the press.
I wonder if you would spend as much time as you want talking about the relationship with Larry Mueller and being on the Larry Mueller show.
Well, back when I first started, on a given day, I would handle 40, sometimes as many as 60 phone calls in the summer when things were really going. And so when I got the opportunity to go on the radio, to be honest, it was just like being in the lab, you know, because Larry's show is a call-in show. And so I found it to be very rewarding. It didn't take me any prep time. You know, we could kind of go there. If there was a particular insect problem, we could bring it to the public's attention and discuss. Although you find in that show, it's hard to predict where it's going to go from one show to the next. And so it basically evolved into a monthly show. And we were just as busy in December talking insects, you know, at times when things were quiet, because there's always something going on and the like. And so I... Every opportunity I got to be on the show, I jumped at it, as I said. And then over the years, was just amazed at the number of people that pick up on public radio. You know, people that recognize my voice. I can be at a place and somebody hears the voice and, you know, are you? And so, yeah, as I said, I always found that to be the I would tell people, the most productive hour and a half I could spend in a week because of impacts. You're getting that information out. You know, the same question about carpenter ants that I would answer once, I could answer on the radio, and there'd be a whole lot of people that had issues that could pick up from that. And Larry was always just is a delight to work with. It's like sitting with your next-door neighbor, you know, he has a nice style. You know, that was originally the farm show. I mean, so for the people in the College of Ag, Larry has a number of regular guests from here, and that was, again, our opportunity to get information out that, you know, statewide. So as I said, I always looked at it to be a great opportunity.
Any calls stand out? I mean, I know you've been doing it for a while, for a long time, but any calls that stand out in your mind?
Well, more prank calls from people I knew. I mean, you can recognize voices, you know. And so every once in a great while, somebody would call up and try to pull my leg. And, you know, with the way it's set up, the producer and Larry, if calls get inappropriate, they can cut people off. A couple other ones, you know, where you had to be a little bit careful. My wife still laughs. And honestly, a physician I had contact with had heard the same. When I was talking with a gentleman, and he was calling from his tractor cab. And he basically had what sounded like a case of pubic lice. And his question is, could you get pubic lice from the tractor seat? Which is kind of an odd question, and one that's a little bit sensitive. And so I kind of walked through it and whatnot as gingerly as I could and felt very comfortable. But both my wife and the physician said they were just laughing at what was going on there. And but as I said, I it just was always just like the normal work day to me as far as the kind of questions that came in. It was just, this happened to be on the radio. You know, the listenership of public radio, the kind of questions that come in, honestly, are usually much more in depth, in much broader scope. It's interesting when I've done these kind of shows for commercial radio. Many times they don't care what the insect is. They don't care, you know, it's anything about its biology. What can I go to the hardware store and buy and get rid of it? Whereas public radio, as I said, people are often interested in the natural history of what's going on and like, and so it's, that part's fun too, because you do get a more diverse kind of question and interest. And now, you know, it's evolved to Facebooks and all kinds of things, pictures sent in and the like.
And so you said this, I just want to follow up in case there's things you want to talk about. You said that, you know, even this time of year, winter, you said December, but winter,
right.
If you were on the show or if you were doing media, there wasn't a slow period. Is that?
No, no. I mean, again, you kind of, but, you know, traditionally, if it's a very bad winter or a lot of snow, then all of a sudden somebody gets the idea, well, how's this going to affect the insect population? And so we'd get those kind of questions coming in. You know, in the winter, people bring in Christmas trees. Occasionally, their Christmas trees have insect issues, usually a nuisance problem. For a while there, when the Lyme disease story was unfolding, there was a urban rumor or legend that deer ticks were overwintering in Christmas trees, which is not true. But, you know, so again, you're often dealing with some of those. And that's one of the things, the way Larry's show is set up. If there's various, you know, insect issues in the media, he'll pick up and we'll kind of get into depth on those, you know. Mm-hmm. We were at a loss for calls. In fact, it's the other way. Usually we can't get to everybody. And
I mean, from what I've read of some of the media that made it into our biographical file, it seemed like, well, I mean, insects rule the world.
Right, right.
And it seems to me that regardless of what the weather would be like in the winter, there's always going to be something to talk about either in the winter or in the spring.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And, you know, and part of this thing is that the changes. And there are climate effects. You know, and again, one of my classic lines is the governor moved us to Missouri 10 years ago and didn't tell us because, you know, what we'd see over time is many insects would extend their range dramatically northward. And it was because of the lack of cold weather. I mean, real cold weather. Mm-hmm. And we always had new species. I mean, I averaged 2 to 3 new detections a year, exotic species or range extensions or whatnot. So, you know, you always had that to deal with. So as I said, we never ran out of things to talk about. And sometimes the same questions would, you know, come up. That's to be expected.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, somewhat to shift gears here, you say, you know, you would identify 2 to 3 new insects each year. How would that, what are the various ways that an insect would come across, you know, either come into the lab or come, you know, come to your attention?
Well, you know, some things we'd stumble in by accident. I mean, people would just find something, had no idea, but it was just a question, what is this, you know, and then you'd work it up and, you know, you're always playing a little detective here because you're given an insect, but you often don't have the full history behind it, you know. And so that's part of the question. You tried to get as much background information from a person, you know, was associated with something, got chipped in here, you know, have you been traveling, these kind of questions. But so when I would have some concerns, and there are some things that are on your radar screen. I mean, like when emerald ash borer had broken out in Michigan, we knew it was coming. It was just a matter of time, you know. But other ones are complete surprises, and, you know, you never were quite sure. But kind of the protocol is if I would run into something that appeared to be exotic, if I could identify it myself, fine. I would look for colleagues both here and sometimes around the nation. You know, there are various experts with various insect groups you could work with. If it appeared to be something that potentially had some economic importance, to be honest, my main contacts were with the USDA, APHIS people, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, and also to a degree with the Wisconsin Department of Ag, because they are, one of their missions is to keep exotic things out and keep track of things. And that was also always very interesting, because if something got to that point where I had to call USDA, if I would send something off to an expert, sometimes it would take weeks to get an answer. If you gave it to USDA, you had an answer within 48 hours. So they were very efficient. And then, you know, you basically decide is if you knew enough about the insect, you could kind of determine, well, yeah, it only breeds in dead wood, so that's not going to get us in any trouble. Or, mm-hmm. No, this is, you know, some brand new pest of oak trees and we're going to run off to it. So then they would kind of make their decision where they had to go. In some cases, they'd have to quarantine stuff. Some cases, they have to destroy things. And so that was always, and it turned out over my career, I was 100% with them. I never gave them something that was not exotic. Mm. And so they didn't like to hear from me a whole lot. But on the other hand, as I said, it was something we all had to deal with. And there's a certain excitement to that kind of stuff, you know, of something new and trying to get some handle on it. So, yeah, lots of interesting cases. And as I said, you kind of expected, and some of these turned out to be, you know, an insect that feeds on a weed, and, you know, yeah, fine, it's from Europe, but it really isn't going to be important. So things would come in from all directions. They really did, and it was just a case of kind of screening. As years went on and you started to see more images that people would send, you could use that as kind of a screening tool. Yeah, no, I need to see this, or no, I don't need to see this type of thing. So,
I don't think I asked this the last time. Where was the physical location of the lab, and did that change over time?
Oh, yes. So interesting enough, when I was a graduate student in the department, my lab was in the basement. And when the position first started, we'd really, you know, so I just continued down in the basement and honestly spent probably the first 20 years of my career in the basement of Russell Labs, B73. There was a little research annex next to it. There was also a chemical storage room. It probably now, with OSHA regulations, was not a place where people should have been, because there was only one exit in the chemicals and the like, but it worked quite well. One of the things that happened over my career is our department and the number of FTEs went down. So when I first started, space was a major problem in the department. But as we started losing positions and the like, space became less of an issue. And so eventually they moved me up into the second floor in 240 Russell Labs, right across from the main office, which was much more convenient because, of course, when people come in with specimens, they'd stop at the office. And it makes a whole lot more sense to be there than to send them down in the basement, which is not the easiest place to find in the way the layout was and the like. But good tornado shelter, though. The basement.
Yeah. All right. So that was the started in basement and moved up to 240. Right. And then that was, so basically, were those your two primary?
Yeah, that was the only two places.
Okay. Just a couple more things today. The first is so chronologically, we're trying to sort of move into the 80s and the 90s, and it's around this time. Again, according to the biographical information we have on you, that you started to receive recognition, get awards for your work. And so the first question is, any of the awards that you got stand out?
Yeah, the one that absolutely was such a pleasant surprise, and I think, I don't know if there's anything that gave me as much adrenaline in my career. I was picked the first year that they offered the Academic Staff Excellence Awards. I received the award for public service. It was the Bob Heidemann Award, and I had the pleasure of getting to know Bob later on. And it was interesting. At that time, again, because of staff changes, I, by default, became the medical entomologist in extension in particular. And we didn't have a medical entomologist for a while when Gene DeFoyer retired and the like. And this was when Lyme disease was unfolding, and there was a whole lot that we didn't know about it, but just trying to get going. So I really was quite active at that time in lecturing off campus on Lyme disease and trying to get as much information. Even had contact with New York Times on some things, because, you know, things were evolving in Wisconsin in a very similar manner to out east, where, you know, Connecticut and where things first started with that. And that probably is the one thing that helped. This award was for public service, but as I said, I was basically getting the opportunity to talk and become an expert on something, and so I think there's a lot of name recognition and the like that was associated with that. And so again, you know, we had a big reception at the Chancellor's house, and I said it was just, and to be among other award winners, and these are all academic staff people. It was interesting. Then after the time, I eventually, you know, sat on the committee that was involved with deciding who was the Excellence Award winners, and that was a very rewarding experience also. And then from our perspective of being academic staff, this was probably the first time I think we got big time, you know, recognition across campus and the like. And as I said, you know, academic staff do a whole lot of things here that very important, and you know, trying to explain people the difference between what academic staff do and what faculty do, and that whole thing. But like I said, I that was a real special recognition. to me.
So, I mean, you answered it for that, for this specific award. So, but I want to ask in general your feelings towards, you know, being recognized for your work. How does it make you feel?
Well, those kind of things, as I said, with when you have those 70 and 80 hour weeks and you're just kind of dragging, those kind of things, a pat on the back, you know. And as I said, I think more just the acknowledgement, you know, there didn't have to be plaques or statues or anything else. It's just the people appreciate what you're doing. As I said, is just great. And often when I had the opportunity, was on various committees of trying to discuss some of those issues at times, as I said, of maybe rather than worrying about one big award, you're better off to have three smaller awards because you're recognizing three people, you know. And it really does, as I said, I think help bolster people, because many times in staff positions, as I said, you probably don't get as much of an opportunity to get the recognition as some of the other, you know, the faculty positions in particular on campus.
Well, let's talk about academic staff. Since you mentioned that this award really, the Academic Staff Award is one that really stood out to you. Yeah. And you talk about being on this committee. So, it looks like from the biographical information we have that really it was starting in the 90s that you started to serve on some academic staff committees.
Yeah, well, originally I became the district rep. And I think somebody had left or whatnot. And so I kind of did as an interim basis. And then I had enough interest. And so the one thing that opened my eyes to is, again, the strong academic staff governance and the whole academic staff committees and what kind of things we were doing, and in particular. And so I did that for a number of years before I became involved with committees, in particular the awards committee. And we also were involved with distributing grant dollars for professional development. Was the two main things of the committee that I was involved with. And I pretty much concentrated on the awards, and other people would take care of the grants for professional improvement. And during that time also, and this is an issue that's come up a number of times, you know, historically when the university got raises, the faculty and academic staff, whatever the raises were the same, but there's been movement for a number of times to decouple these. And so in one of the years when the legislature was looking at this, I was asked to testify in front of a legislative committee about what kind of things academic staff do. So I was more than happy. And, you know, in the way I tried to explain it to him is that, you know, there are things that need to be done in the mission of the university, the department, or whatnot, that honestly you can't get tenure for. You know, but they still have to be done. And even the argument with the diagnostic lab. So by that time, I guess I had enough public recognition because of all the media and the like. Most people assumed I was a faculty member of the department. But yet, if that was the only thing a faculty person were to do, because of the lack of research and the like, there's no way they'd get tenure. And so that was my explanation, is that, you know, we do a lot of the things that need to be done, but yet, you know, and some it's teaching, some in research. You know, in my case, a lot of it was extension also. But as I said, we're still covering the bases and the like, and it worked. Although I did get set up for that one a little bit, and this is just kind of a personal story, but I have a cousin who was involved with state government, and a woman who went to high school with him came up afterwards. And my cousin and I are the same age. And she introduced herself and said she knew my cousin Joe, and her first question to me was, "Are you his father?" And at first I was really taken aback, and then I finally realized that Joe set me up, but that's a different issue. But
Who were some of the folks that you got to know and got to work with as you became involved in academic staff governance?
Kathy Middlecamp, I remember, and she was the president of academic staff for a time. And Kathy and I had some, continued to have interactions afterwards. And in fact, even one of my children took chemistry from her. and she was really quite active at that time. Phil Hellman, who happens to be the father of the famous poker player.
Right.
And he was very active at that time, again. And I'm slipping me the woman from education. I can picture her. But again, I part of it with being associated with the College of Ag, this opened the opportunity to colleagues, and especially in letters and science and the like. And then eventually on many of the other committees, you know, the large contingent of academic staff in the medical school and the like. And so, you know, it was just always amazing to see the diversity. And again, similar people, you know, world-renowned physicists and whatnot that are academic staff. And as I said, and so that went back to this point of trying to promote, as I said, what kind of things that the academic staff do on campus.
I think you've answered this, but I want to ask it directly. So you said in this committee, you know, you had to talk about academic staff. But how would you describe it, you know, if somebody came to you and said, well, you know, you're not faculty, you're staff. What does that mean? What do you do?
Well, you know, in some other institutions, they're called professional staff or the like. I mean, some of the problem, I think, is just the name of trying to understand. And so, as I said, we do the same things, is that there are people that are doing research as their primary mission. There's other people that do teaching and lecturing as their primary mission. And then if there's a service or public service aspect and the like. So we're doing the same things that faculty do. Again, we have somewhat different masters, and although there are people that publish a lot, as I said, when you kind of look at what faculty members are judged on and the like, it really does come in most cases down to their research and the like. And so there's a very important component to that, which may not necessarily, academic staff may be doing a lot of the day-to-day research, maybe not necessarily having the pressure to publish at the same level or in the same journals and the like. And so, as I said, but when you look at the responsibilities of departments and the like, there's a lot of things that have to get done. And as I said, in a lot of cases here, academic staff do a great job of doing it. And you can make the argument, free up some of the faculty so that they can do some of the other things that they have to get done.
So a couple more things. First, so you've talked about research and publication in this last answer. What sort of publication work, what sort of writing were you doing, for the sort of the first half of your career, if you will, from the 70s through the...
Well, a lot of it. So, you know, with extension information, you know, we do a lot of bulletins and other, you know, kind of information pieces to people. And so I was involved quite a bit with that. You know, if you had new pests, you had to come up with, you know, information sheets on, you know, what they look like, what do they do, and how do we deal with them. So we were always involved with ongoing, and you know, many of these things we would some cases every year, you know, our recommendations for growing tomatoes. As I said, you know, pesticides change, the like, so we were always involved with yearly revisions of extension bulletins and the like. And I mean, other things would come to pass of magazines that would do articles. I got involved with Fine Home Building, wanted me to do an article on insects in wood. And so, you know, I was more than happy to kind of put that together. So a lot of popular press type pieces, mm-hmm. Although that was not a priority if I had the opportunity. As I said, the extension bulletins in particular were by far the most important. And eventually things got, we used to have a very formal system where you had to make proposals, and it often would take a couple years to get a bulletin on board. That's one of the nice things of the modern era, where, you know, we can get information up in a day or two, mm-hmm. You know, when we need it. So it really was much more useful for our purposes, because that's all we were interested in, is getting good information pieces available for people.
So I want to end with, when we talked at the end of the first interview, you said you'd just gotten married. You initially lived out in an apartment on the south side of town. I assume at some point you moved somewhere else. I wonder if you could talk about.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. Housing demand is so much of a yo-yo, but So the time we were looking at, and even though, again, I didn't have solid funding, my wife had a permanent position. So we ended up buying a house. The first evening we went out to look for it, and the house was only about a mile and a half west of campus, which was a delight, so I could walk in and bike in a neighborhood. It was, you know, a relatively small house, but we had to make an offer immediately. I mean, houses were going in a day or two, so you had no chance. And again, with both my father-in-law and my dad around, that was helpful, because you know, never buying a house, you at least got some of their input, although I think anybody, their first home, you learn a whole lot of things. You know, even location. It was a great location, but it was a somewhat busy street, which mm-hmm. is going to have implications when you sell it down the road. I mean, things you just don't think of the first time as home buyer. But they worked out. It's just an absolutely lovely neighborhood on North Franklin Avenue, which is a couple blocks west of West High School. And eventually my children went there. And honestly, it served our purposes very well until we had two children, and until they started getting to be middle school age. And then the way I tell it is, it was very difficult to have four different styles of music going on in such a small house. We needed a bigger place. And so my mom had passed. My dad lived in a home on farther on the west side. And we were trying to stay in the same neighborhood. We liked the schools, we liked the neighbors, but it just looked like the houses that would give us more space we really couldn't afford. My dad said, well, why don't you buy our house, the house that he was in. They had owned it for about 4 or 5 years, and it was in the right school district. I don't have good vision on what possibilities. The house wasn't very appealing to me, but that's because of the carpet and the drapes and everything else. And once we kind of got rid of that stuff, that's where we ended up moving, and that has also worked out very well. And one of the nice things, even though it's a little bit more of a hike, in fact, I didn't walk. I would bike once in a while, but still it was close enough to campus. I can get on campus in about 5 or 6 minutes. And so you know, with growing up in this city, it was so much smaller and so much less commuting headache. And so I never found it appealing to live way out, even though I love the outdoors, to live way out of town and have to commute and go through the traffic. So it's always nice to stay in. So we call it the Near West Side now. It's over by Odana Golf Course. But yet again, when I was growing up, that was the outskirts of the city. So mm-hmm. things have changed.
And one last thing. So you talked earlier about, you know, getting a pat on the back particularly was nice after working long weeks, long hours. How did you balance, you know, your work life and your home life?
Well, you know, the one luxury, you know, in the position, even though I answered the department, I really was my own boss. And so I still did have the freedom enough that if my kids were involved with a, you know, some kind of play or whatnot, I could sneak out, you know, and see what was going on and come back. I think, you know, again, we kind of learned it. What's interesting about extension positions is, honestly, you would dread the 1st of January, because from the 1st of January till about the 1st of April, you're the busiest, at least being on the road. So lots of travel, lots of night meetings, lots of weekends and the like. And I often would tease, but usually by the 1st of April, I was sick of lecturing. I mean, to the point, in fact, one year I developed vocal nodules from voice strain from in some cases, probably over-projecting when I was talking, but it was, you know. And then 1st of April, I was ready to sit down in the lab and answer the phone. By the 1st of September, I was so sick of talking on the phone, let me get out and lecture again. So it was really a nice balance. You know, the way things went through, but I never felt, you know, some of it was just, this is the responsibility of the job. This is kind of what comes with the territory. So I didn't feel overburdened with it. Although eventually that's, I think, the thing that wears on you. Of my mentor told me he got to a point where you just don't recover like when you're younger. And that's eventually, you know, what happens to all of us. And what happened to me is I finally got to that point and say, This is a little bit more taxing than I think I want to deal with. So,
Phil, is there anything else you want to talk about today?
No, I think other than, you know, I'd mentioned a little bit, the interesting thing about that era in particular, I think, was this whole Lyme disease story, which I have found to be scientifically the most fascinating unfolding story, because it's more than just Lyme disease. We had a tick that showed up kind of out of nowhere. The first deer tick was discovered in Wisconsin in 1969. One of Gene DeFoliart's students had published, he was doing a dissertation on the parasites of mice, and he found this odd tick. This tick was known in the southern United States, but had never been seen this far north. At that time, it was before Lyme disease was discovered. This turns out to be the bridge of it. And so watching that unfold, trying to understand the dynamics, since then we have found that this tick is involved with a number of other diseases. So it's kind of a constant changing story. The tick has distributed itself throughout the state. We've seen the infectivity rate move from 15% to better than 40% in the adult tick. So it's, again, it's continued to evolve. And I had was drawn into it, as I said, a lot of people interested in what was going on still to this day. I mean, that is a very, very common request to come out and talk about ticks and the like. It's a little ticklish because it's a medical side to this. You know, there's a real, medically, a very can of worms involved with Lyme disease in humans and diagnosis and the like. And of course, that's a little bit out of an entomologist's expertise. Ours is to concentrate on the tick biology and some of those dynamics. But as I said, I still find that fascinating, but that was my chance to get involved. And as I said, we didn't have reinforcements for the time. Thank goodness we eventually did get another medical entomologist after Gene DeFoliart had retired, Susan Paskowitz, and you know, her lab has done a lot of research to help us kind of clarify some of these things that's going on and the like. But like I said, if there's one issue that I could point to that really both intellectually is just fascinating, but also, as I said, probably gave me as much recognition as anything is over the years working with that.
Okay. Well, I think that'll wrap it up for the day.
Sounds
so
good.
Phil, thank you very much for your time. This concludes the follow-up interview with Phil Pelletier.